From the beautiful Finger Lakes region of upstate New York, this is the Dental Lighthouse Podcast. We take questions from anyone in the dental profession and discuss what it takes to win not only in dentistry, but in life. Business, leadership, relationships, parenting, health and wellness, money management, nothing is off limits on the Dental Lighthouse Podcast. I'm Jason Tenori, your host, and have over 20 years of experience to pull from. Learn from my mistakes and let me help you collapse time so you can become the best version of yourself. Next on the show, we have Pete from Colorado. Pete, welcome to the Dental Lighthouse Podcast. How can I help you?
Hey, Jason. Right now we have, we're going through some growing pains at the office. We are needing to bring on another associate, and I've had multiple associates over the years in my former practice, and some here. Some have been really great. Some have been a challenge. I've had a partner in the past, but as we kind of gear up to start this hunt in my current practice, there is a little bit different dynamics here, and I want to make sure I'm vetting this individual properly and kind of looking for the right person, having the right avatar of who I'm looking for, and just how do I find that individual.
Love it. I love that you're thinking that way.
So in the past, in my former office, I had a practice for 12 plus years in another state. We've had different associates, and in the past, I've just kind of, I mean, we've been very, very blessed over the years. People have seemed to, we've never had to try too hard to find people. People have kind of come to us, and we've never had to look too hard. A lot of times, though, they've been fairly new docs, right out of residency, maybe. Actually, I did hire somebody who was directly out of school without a residency at one point too, which I would have thought that would have been really bad, and it wasn't. It was great, but it's in my current practice. I think we have a very high standard of care here. You know, we're doing a lot more complex procedures. We are very much a reputation-based office, and I hate to bring in somebody who's not maybe able to deliver that same quality of care and customer service and all the things that are important to our practice here.
Right, 100%. Yeah. So is your question more on how do we best vet a prospective associate, or how, you know, obviously there's no cookbook to like get it right every single time, but how do we minimize any risks associated with bringing in a bad apple? Is that kind of the direction that you're going?
Yes, it is. We live in an area that we would have to bring someone in from an out of town. There's not just a bunch of dentists where we're at.
Right.
So, you know, I take that very seriously too. I don't want to, we're affecting people's lives. I don't want to bring somebody in for a short-term dating thing.
Right.
Because there's a lot of commitment on that individual's part. So, we do have a responsibility to take care of them, provide a good income, be able to support their family. And, but on the same side, on the other side here, we have a responsibility to our practice and to our patients to provide the best care that we can.
Right.
And find a good fit. So, some of the people I'm speaking with are from another state. How can I determine whether they're going to be a good culture fit, a good clinical fit, and all the things before we actually make that big commitment to one another to bring them into the office?
Yeah, super good question. And it's a little bit more complicated than most situations because someone's probably going to have to relocate based on what you're describing. And I love your heart being where, you know, you're as worried about them as you're worried about you guys. And I think that's half the battle, just making sure that your intentions are to create a win-win situation and not where you guys are parasitic, for lack of a better term. Yeah, I love it. So a couple things to think about, and none of this is, you know, right or wrong, but just some things that are popping into my head as you describe your situation is, doing as much work as you can remotely, to help the vetting process, right? So phone calls, Zoom calls, reference checks, you know, let's just throw some numbers on here. Let's say you have 10 prospective people. You know, how do we whittle that down to 5, right? From my perspective, that's through a couple of Zoom calls. It's through a couple of phone calls. It's through checking references, stuff like that, right? And I'm assuming that you're doing that ahead of time before bringing anyone in.
Right.
Right. So you got your list down to, you know, half of the initial applicant pool. I don't know how it works in your particular state, but one of the things that we have found to be tremendously successful is working interviews. So if you could somehow figure out a way to schedule said applicant for a day or so where, you know, you're not going to be putting all on X cases in their chair, but our working interviews will consist of, you know, a filling, an extraction, assuming that they've told you in the vetting process that they're competent at extractions, maybe a crown, a couple limited exams, a couple hygiene checks. And then I'm putting that particular prospective associate with my best assistant or my most trusted assistant, because I'm trying to figure out a couple of things. I'm trying to figure out, do they know how to talk to people? Do they have a level of empathy that we try to have in the practice? How are they clinically? You know, everything from something as simple as giving a painless injection. You know, there's a lot of doctors, unfortunately, that's not even really something that they worry about. And that doctor's not going to do well in my practice. And I'm going to be able to tell a couple patients in if that's something that they care about or not. You know, and then just having either myself or this trusted assistant constantly be there during this working interview to see how they're treating people, how their clinical dentistry is, you know, stuff like that. If you can get away with that, if you can somehow get a license that works in your state or a temporary license or something like that, that's a great solution in my opinion. And then I would have it be a multi-day thing. I would say, you know, we're gonna fly you in. This is gonna be a 2-day event where it's a half day working interview, and then we're gonna go out to dinner, and then the following day it's another half day working interview, and this, you know, meeting some of the leads or what have you. In my opinion, that's probably the best way that you can vet an out of state or out of the area applicant. Now, is that a foolproof way? Absolutely not. But it's way better than, you know, just going with your gut on, while they look great via Zoom, let's offer them a job. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really like that. And I never had given any thought to, I've thought about having people come in for work and interviews, but some of these people are from out of state. And now that you say that, I know that Colorado does allow temporary licenses because CSI uses those for their training on docs.
Right.
So I'll absolutely explore what that would take to get for somebody. That's a really good idea.
Yeah, that's been our best tool. And you know, fortunately or unfortunately, you can tell in the first 2 hours, right? Like, you'll be able to know right away just how they talk to the team, how they talk to the patient. It's sometimes, unfortunately, it's a lot different when how they talk to you and your spouse, right? Like, they're on their best behavior when they're talking to you or your spouse, but you know, when they get in an operatory, if they're not maintaining eye contact, if they're not truly listening to the assistant or the patient, that's a sign, man. That's a sign that this is not going to be a good thing. And it sucks that you paid for getting them in there and you put them up in a hotel. But man, I can tell you based on experience that it is so much less expensive than someone that you do hire. And after 30 or 60 days, you're like, wow, I made a huge mistake here. And then to your point earlier in the call, you uprooted this person. And now how do we get out of this?
Yeah. That's a big consideration for me for sure. And, I think that is just the way to go.
Cool.
Cause we're looking for confidence, right? That's another big part of it. And, people can sound confident and when they're speaking with me on the phone, but when they get in front of a patient, or they're trying to diagnose, a limited exam or even go through some treatment plans and see how they would, plan a case out. That's a big difference.
Yeah. 100%. But you know, even that arguably could be vetted remotely, right? So you get it down to five people and they're all interested and you're interested. You know, what's the harm with getting on a second Zoom call and showing them a pan and some clinical photographs? And yeah, just curious what you would do here. So I think anything you can do to vet the process before flying them in, getting them in the hotel, because at the end of the day, I would think you want to narrow it down to say three people, have them come in and then really be excited about two or three out of those people moving forward. Along the same lines, I would make sure that from a financial perspective, those expectations are managed. Because I can only share from experience that, we've had people that we have fallen in love with. We're ready to offer them the job. We finally send them the job offer and they look at the compensation and they were like, oh, I was expecting twice this. And you're like, whoa, okay. I didn't manage that very well. So, having those conversations ahead of time just saves you a lot of, headache.
Yeah. Right. Well, do you mind if we jump into that for just a minute or two?
Yeah, for sure.
The compensation piece, I mean, associate compensation, is that fairly standard across the country? I mean, it's generally a percentage of adjusted production. Is that correct?
In my world, it is. The percentage kind of fluctuating based on experience or fluctuating based on maybe a tiered level. Whereas, you know, the first $50,000 is going to be at 30% and then up to 75,000 at 33% and over 100,000, 35%. So there's lots of different models out there, but to your question, yeah, it can be fairly standard, across the board.
Okay. What about offering some sort of, guaranteed minimum? I've typically done that in the past. And we've never really had any problems with people hitting that. But, how important is that in your experience as far as an offer? And how long do you keep something like that going?
So we have daily guarantees for all of our associates, and they're actually in perpetuity. The reality is that after 30 to 60 days, they rarely need it because we have some good things going in terms of our ability to support that associate doctor. And I know you do too. I would be less inclined to have a daily guarantee that is extended for a long period of time if I didn't have all my ducks in a row, right? If my new patient flow was low, if I didn't have enough chairs, if my confirmation processes were not good, then I got a situation where I'm paying this doctor a decent amount of money and not keeping him busy. So him or her busy. So I don't have any problem with a daily guarantee because I know that they're going to be busy. I have the room for them. I have the staff for them. So if that's the security blanket that a prospective doctor needs, I don't have a problem offering that.
Right. And if there's a whole lot of days where they're, you're giving them all the resources to succeed and they're not able to do that, then it's time to have another conversation.
Amen. And then kind of along those lines is when a prospective associate asks me for a specific daily minimum, I will, and this took me a lot of courage to figure this out, I will ask them for a W-2 based on their current or previous job. And because I will clearly say, I want you to come to work for this organization and see a jump in your income. I don't want money to play a factor in this at all. So if you're asking for $1,000 a day daily guarantee, because that's what you currently do, send me a tax return. And if that's what I know you have the capabilities of producing, then I will match that. It's the ones that are asking for those guarantees. And then you start to peel the onion back and they're only doing like $1,500 a day in revenue. And you're like, okay, I really just screwed myself by agreeing to this daily guarantee.
Right. Yep, for sure. Okay. That's good. All really, really helpful stuff.
Good stuff, man. You're going to kill it. I'm excited to hear about the vetting process and who you bring in and who's going to ultimately grow with you. And, you know, maybe you can sprinkle in some potential equity into the deal and, you know, we can hop on another call and kind of unpack that. But, man, I'm really excited for you. You're going to crush it.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, thanks so much, Jason.
Thanks for the call, Pete. I'll talk to you soon, brother. Next to the show is Dr. Paul Goodman. Dr. Goodman is a multi-practice owner in Philadelphia, New York. Dr. Paul, welcome to the Dental Lighthouse podcast. How are you doing?
Glad to be talking with you, Jason.
I'm not as glad as I am to be talking to you, Paul. How can I help you?
I mean, what I would really like help with is, I know you through DSI, DSN, also everyone knows, I know you from back in 2000's time at Penn Dental School, and just admire that you build this group that of dentist, team members, hygienists, assistants. And I really would like help with, how do you get your associates calibrated? How do you get the patients to have confidence in them? How do you get their clinical skills to impress upon associates that doing a good job is most important? And then also not taking too long is important. So really, I think as someone who has put a lot of training into their team calibration and systems, I just would like some help with, how do we get our associate dentist in the place for them to be as successful as possible? And I find that to be a challenge at times.
Yeah, you and me both. I mean, it's a huge challenge. Where specifically do you have obstacles now? How are you evaluating success? I'm curious as to know your thoughts on that.
And it's a great question. I think one of the things, the biggest obstacle is really with the length of time that it takes to complete the procedure. And in the defense of our associates, that doesn't necessarily mean they hold the burr too long on a class two. It is just the entire experience. I mean, recently we've invested in Dr. Nicholas's associate accelerator, where they can get some help from outside of, you know, I work with my brother, Dr. Jeff Goodman, outside of us. But it's just that, you know, how can the team who's scheduling these patients and waiting for the next patient have confidence that they're going to be finished on time? Sometimes are they going to ask for help early enough? Like, I don't know if you've experienced that, Jason, and I've done it as a new dentist, and sometimes I'm afraid to ask for help, and not asking for help messes up the whole day, right?
Yeah, no question.
If I just paused and had the, you know, I don't know, internal fortitude to just go to, at the time, my dad, maybe his partner, and say, hey, this patient is doing X, Y, Z, what would you do? So those are some of the things. Some of them, I think, do have to do with clinical skills, but then a lot of it has to do with communication and just being able to manage the appointment in a way where everybody wins at the end.
Yeah, no doubt. It's such an obstacle in dentistry, and I know you've experienced it. We experience it as well. So I got a couple of thoughts. You know, and you mentioned Dr. Aaron Nichols. So he's one of the guys that can really help with this problem. You know, Lincoln from Ripe Global can really help with this problem. I find personally that if we can manage expectations from the associate's perspective early on in the process, you know, the first day of the onboarding, or more importantly, even during the interviewing process, then we are that much closer to where we want to be. So what do I mean by that? Well, how long does it take to do a two surface filling? Worst case scenario, a patient shouldn't be in the operatory more than an hour. And that's in my opinion, the absolute worst case scenario. Now, there obviously there's situations where I couldn't get the patient numb, or it was an extremely large two surface filling and recurrent caries, all this jazz. But managing the expectation of, you know, when you're doing a two surface filling, when you're doing crown prep, all things being equal, you cannot have the patient in the room any more than 2 hours. And if they're really taken aback by that, then I think it's an opportunity for the senior doctor, you, me, someone else that is sitting in this clinical director seat, so to speak, to get in the room with that patient, with that associate, and be the in-person on-site mentor that they need to be. So in our organization, if I see that someone is struggling with time management, then they're going to assist me by doing a two surface filling. They're going to assist me during a crown prep so they can see how efficient the procedure can be and still maintain a specific level of not only quality dentistry, but, patient experience. And once they see me do it 3, 4, 5 times, then I'm going to assist them and I'm going to suck spit and I'm going to say, you know, no, go, go, yeah, go. And the problem that I've run into, and I do a lot of coaching with DSI, as you know, is we hire these associates, but we don't have the capacity to give them the mentorship that they need and deserve. So there's this mindset in dentistry of like, man, I'm so busy. As soon as I hire an associate, I'll be freed up. Well, the reality is, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, as soon as we hire this associate, we're basically signing up for a 20-hour a week part-time job. Totally. In addition, yeah, to what we're already doing, because who else is going to be responsible for growing this person? If it's not me, then the answer is nobody. So those are some of the things that I've done.
I like that. Tell me about this with your, because I know you have, you know, multiple practices. You know, you were to hire a new associate general dentist. They don't have to be a new dentist, a new associate dentist to you. What is their, like, I'm using their watch Jason time look like, watch someone time look like? You know, I think some of these practice owners, we feel conflicted because we're like, we'd love to invest in some of this mentorship, but we got a lot of patients. You know, is the associate going to feel like they're being babied? Do they need this time? One of my close friends says he regrets not having a longer time where the associate just hung around with him like you expected. So what does that look like in your group?
Yeah, it does. It depends a little bit on how tenured the doc is. You know, someone right out of their residency, and I'm in New York State, so I have a little bit of an advantage in the sense that you can't receive a New York State license without a general, yeah, practice residency. So they have a little bit more experience, but it really depends on their level of experience, where if it's a fairly new grad or someone right out of their residency, you know, we have a 90-day onboarding period where, again, they're not just going to be watching or observing for 90 days, but of those 90 days, the first 3 to 4 weeks, a great majority of it is going to be spent in the operatory observing how one of our senior docs is doing it. How are they talking to the patient? How are they presenting treatment? How are they empathetically listening to the patient? How is the doc cutting a crown prep and asking questions? And it's funny, you can start to tell early on in the process if they're inquisitive, if they're curious, if they're asking the myself or one of my other senior docs, you know, why'd you do it this way? Why'd you do it that way? Then you know they're going to be okay. It's the ones that kind of think that the observation period is a waste of time. I know how to do this. I graduated from dental school. Like, those are the ones that typically don't last very long, or we have to have an uncomfortable conversation much earlier in the process than I, yeah, thought we were going to have to. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but you graduate from dental school, you graduate from a residency, and there's two mindsets. You know, the first negative mindset is, I've arrived, you know, where's my kingdom? And then the second mindset is, okay, I'm really willing to get after it. I'm really willing to learn. I'm really willing to try to become the best version of myself. And, you know, hopefully we're higher in the ladder.
I agree with you. I wanted to also add in, this is, I really am enjoying some of your tips here. But you know what I think? I know I thought of this from my awesome associates. Some of the challenges is they're doing a procedure and their procedure is going well in their operatory. But then we ask them to check one or two hygienists and they could be walking into anything, right? And if they're new to the practice, they don't know that Millie asked 14 questions about this. How do you help them manage the hygiene check where your patient feels, where the patient feels like they're still getting a good exam? But we have had challenges where they've been, you know, held hostage by the patient for 24 minutes and thrown the whole schedule off. And I actually remember those times. And that's a tough place to be in. How do you guys help with that?
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, that's what makes dentistry so hard, right? It's like, it would be easy if it wasn't for the patient, right?
Yeah.
We've said that a lot of times. So not to sound redundant, but from my perspective, it comes to managing expectations. So for example, right, we're coaching up our associates of, okay, if you're going to give a block, if you're going to do a crown or a filling, you give this anesthetic and you tell the patient, this anesthetic is going to take 20 minutes to really soak in. It's not that I'm, you know, trying to avoid you, but I don't want to start before the anesthetic really soaks in. So the patient already realizes, okay, he's going to be back and, or she's going to be back in 20 minutes. Where sometimes if you don't have that expectation, that's very clear to you or I, but not to the patient. 5 minutes after the injection, they're like, well, where the hell is my doctor, right? Yes. When's he going to start the procedure? So you have to manage that expectation. You give the block and then that gives you, and then from a self-awareness perspective for the associate, now you know you have 15, 20 minutes to go do one or two hygiene exams, right? Or if it's in the middle of the appointment, you know, you just finished taking a scan and Mrs. Jones, Mary's going to make you a temporary crown. She's amazing. She makes the best temporary crowns in the office. It's typically a 15 to 20 minute procedure to make a temporary crown that's perfect. I'll come back in and check it. Just wanted you to be aware. So that kind of creates a little bit of capacity for you as the associate. The other part of it is managing the hygiene appointment. And again, I think that this is something that also has to be taught. So we have our associates observe our senior doctors doing hygiene appointments, and then we will either observe them doing hygiene exams or we'll record them doing hygiene exams, and then we'll watch the recording together. And as a general rule, not every practice philosophy is different, but you should be able to get in and out of a hygiene exam in about 5 to 10 minutes. And this comes with time. This doesn't come with, you know, someone that's only been out for, you know, 6 to 12 months. But if you start to see things going sideways, if you start to see the wheels coming off, and the example you gave is, you know, Mrs. Jones just starts asking a barrage of questions. And, you know, we have language that works, you know, 95% of the time that, you know, Mrs. Jones, I really want to be able to answer all of these questions. I wasn't expecting you know, you to have this level of these in-depth questions. There's a lot going on with your care. I would be doing you a disservice if I tried to answer these questions, you know, quickly to get back to my regularly scheduled patients. Is there any possible way that we can dedicate some time specifically to what, you know, you're asking me? It'll give me an opportunity to really learn your case inside and out. We can set up a consultation appointment and I'll have all the answers that you need. Now, if someone's truly interested in these answers, if you use language like, you know, Mrs. Jones, give me, and I've said this before, I'm going to come in on the weekend. I'm going to study your x-rays. I'm going to study your scans. I'm going to study your models. I'm going to learn your case inside and out. I'm going to learn it by heart and I'll be super well prepared to answer any questions that you have next week. Can we get you back for those questions and answers? Like, almost never does a patient say no to that.
I love that, Jason. I just want to I would say, I don't want to interrupt, I just interject with brilliant ideas. That's what my wife says. Don't ask me, just take my opinion for it. Take my word for it. But I was just there on Tuesday with a new patient consult. And, you know, these people come with all of this emotion and they go, what's the cost going to be? And it's taken me a long time at the age of 46 to look a patient in the face and say, I love what you said. I didn't use the exact language, but it would be a disservice if I gave you an answer without taking the time to really look at everything that's going on. So like you said, with our implant work, it's great because our barometer is, hey, let's come back and get a 3D x-ray. It's $300. It's not the exact thing. And we're going to look at it with our specialist. And then I see if they're interested, right? And if they're interested, they say, yes, I'll come back to that. But I think for new dentists, it's stressful because sometimes the patient's like, what do I need? How much is it going to cost? And, you know, when you're in the, you're literally, you know, 12 inches away from someone. And I want to ask you, Jason, because I love your just approach to a lot of things. It is pretty crazy we have to check hygiene and do the clinical procedures. Can you find any other like technical profession that does that? I can't.
No, you're absolutely right.
I mean, I was a resident at Einstein. I got to see some amazing things. Not once during the kidney transplant did anyone tap the surgeon on the shoulder and be like, hey, could you just take like a 10-minute break and go over there and like check these patients in the waiting room? And I mean, you have to give whatever the right fee is, empathy, sympathy. It's a lot on your brain to have to deal with two different human beings, three different human beings, four different human beings in the same hour with different problems. So I just wanted everyone to kind of like, if they're listening to this, they like, it's hard for everybody, right?
Yeah. Amen, brother. That's super well said. It's what makes, what's the phrase you use? Dentisting? It's what makes dentisting so difficult.
Yeah. I say the dentisting is full contact arts and crafts on people that don't want to be there, pay for it, but we got to do it anyway, right? And you know, we're transforming lives, helping people chew and smile with confidence. And how do our patients feel? Pretty annoyed about it. They feel pretty annoyed about it, right? So, you know, I think, but your tips there, I watched the show The Bear with my wife. It's a great show about a chef, and it was the guy from Shameless. I don't know if you haven't seen it, you should see it. And he was a high-level chef. He has to go back to Chicago, resurrect his family restaurant. And you see how chefs are trained, and they literally get to chop food next to each other,
right,
and learn before. And the patients never see that. And by patients, I say, you know, customers. And dentistry is hard because we're basically doing it on the patient all the time.
Right.
I like your take home, and you've inspired me to do more of this role modeling, right?
You know? Well, you got to have the capacity for it. I mean, that's the issue. Like we struggle as owners to have the capacity for it. And if you can have the capacity for it, then there's nothing better than getting in the room. That's how most of my senior docs learn how to place implants and take out wisdom teeth. And, you know, they watch me do half the mouth, and then as they assisted me, and then I would assist them as they did the other half of the mouth. But if you don't have the capacity, that's when the wheels come off. So just make sure you have that built in before you just start bringing on associates. And again, I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
No, I mean, this is, I want to add one tip I can add to your listeners is when I help associates find their first, second, or third job, one of the most important questions I tell them to ask the practice owner or the regional director is this question. I don't think people think to ask this is, how often will I be the only dentist in the practice? Because even if you hired me, Jason, to take care of one of your practices, I don't know all of your systems. I don't know your culture. I don't know anything. So how often will I be the only licensed dentist there? And if you're new to this profession and you hear, oh, all the time, that can be a very, very difficult road for you, unless you have some sort of amazing onboarding process where you get to go to the flagship office and be onboarded. Because I did that for a while, for like 6 or 7 years, every Thursday, I played solo GP at our satellite practice. And that was some of the most stressful Thursdays of my life. I was doing the least complex clinical procedures, Jason. And I was like, go home at the end of the day and just needed to lay down.
Yeah. Now there's so much truth to that. And again, I've been doing this a long time, and we just relearned this lesson with one of our associates last month, where she's from the area. She insisted that she wanted to work in our smaller offices and not our flagship. We traditionally bring all of our new associates through the flagship just so they can really get the culture and really get our systems down and everything. And then we put them in smaller offices if that's what they want. And I agreed to have her bypass that and just go into the smaller offices. And it was not nearly the onboarding experience that she deserved. And it was a slap in the face for me that, you know, I want to meet the requests that I have of prospective associates, but I do need to develop some non-negotiables early on in the process. And one of them is, you're going to spend 90 days in the flagship because you're like, I get it. You know how to cook, but you don't know how to cook in our kitchen. And this is how you learn how we do things. This is our kitchen. We want you to learn how to cook in our kitchen. And then, you know, once you go through that onboarding process, you know, sky's the limit. You can go anywhere the hell you want, and you're going to be successful.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Really, I mean, some things I think, like you said, it's just reinforcing the things that we know work. And all of us, no matter how good your leader are, sometimes you don't commit to the system you know that works, and you regret it in some way. And that's happened to me too.
Right? No doubt.
No doubt. You know, and so, well, I really appreciate your insight on this, Jason. Anything else you want to talk about? Cheesesteaks or pretzels or pen time? I'm glad to, but that was a great.
No, it was I love talking to you, Paul, and we'll have to do it more. But I mean, we can end this call with the realization that Geno's is definitely the best cheesesteak on South Street, right?
Yeah, we got a whole thing. I don't know. Geno's, there's many new ones now. My team member wrote the cheesesteak blog on Dental Nacho's website. I think he has them in the middle. So
I'll have to check it out.
Back to a course. And I do appreciate, I learned a lot of things from you, Jason, but I've also referred to over this holiday season, the gentleman's cube many times when I got an old fashioned. So I appreciate it. Always learning from Jason Tenort.
All right, Paul, really appreciate the time. Have an awesome day, brother.
You too.
Thank you. That wraps up another episode of the Dental Lighthouse podcast. You have a choice today. Choose to be a lighthouse. Lighthouses are powerful and steadfast. They are beacons of light for others to reference when life gets turbulent. Go out into the world today and become a lighthouse for someone. Give more than you get. True joy comes from serving others. Start today. I'm Jason Tenorio, your host. Thank you for listening to the Dental Lighthouse podcast. For more information, podcast show notes, or links to anything that we have discussed today, please check out our website, thedentallighthouse.com. We would love to hear from you. If you would like to get on the show, please email us at podcast@thedentallighthouse.com.